Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's a real delight for me to introduce to you James Nye. He's just a marvelous young scientist, a rising star in the field of ecology, and someone who I'm just thrilled to have amongst our faculty. James is currently an associate professor of biological sciences in our EBE section. He graduated from Harvard magna cum laude and received his PhD from Cornell. And really, since his PhD work, he's been very much focused on the whole world of bee behavior, particularly, as you'll hear tonight, in these classes of stingless bees. And, of course, James really represents the field of ethology, the challenges of studying behavior in the natural environment, and really thinking about how these behaviors contribute to the fitness of a population of organisms. Where do these behaviors come from? How much is nature versus nurture? These are the kind of things that James touches on, and ultimately thinking about how do complex behaviors in populations evolve. It's really a fascinating topic. You don't only have to take my word for how great James is. He's received many awards while at Harvard. He was a junior fellow there. He's had a Howard Hughes pre-doctoral fellowship. He was offered a Fulbright fellowship to study in Würzburg, but had many other fellowship opportunities thrown at him. And also, he held for a while the Heiligenberg Professorship of Neuroethology at UCSD. He's one of the great rising stars in his field. We're all very lucky tonight to be able to capture him from in between his field trips to Panama and other amazing places. So please join me tonight in welcoming Professor James Nye.
Thank you, Dr. K. And it's a great pleasure to be here and to talk to you a little bit about some of my work, and I think more importantly, to help spread the word about the importance that bees play in our environment, in our ecosystem. Well, I'd like to begin today with talking about the sort of outline of the talk. So what are bees? Why are they important? And moreover, how do they communicate? Then we'll be looking in specifically at the type of communication systems they have, and then finally focusing on acoustic communication. Well, here is a honeybee, probably a familiar sight to us in our gardens and around. And what's interesting is that this bee has such an amazing ability, given its small brain size, to not only communicate, but to play a large role within our ecosystem. The bees, as you can see here, and this is a chronogram showing the evolution of bees, the honeybees evolved around 32 to 42 million years ago, and the stingless bees, which I'll be focusing on, came a little bit later, 16 to 25 million years ago. In fact, this large explosion of bee species came about in lockstep with the evolution of the flowering plants, the angiosperms. So what we have in this group here, we have the stingless bees, the bumblebees, which I'm sure we're also familiar with, the honeybees, and a group which is not as well known, but if you've ever been in the tropics and you've seen a brilliant bee almost look like an emerald or a sapphire, these are the orchid bees, and these are largely solitary. Well, why are bees important? In fact, the importance of bees in human culture has been recognized for quite a long time. We find Neolithic burials in which people are actually buried with honey. It's been used medicinally and religiously for a quite long period. And here you actually see from an Egyptian tomb from 700 BCE in which you have symbols of the good life, hives, and the bees that come with them. Closer to home, it's quite interesting what we rediscover about bees. This is the Madrid Codex, and it dates from about 1400. It is a product of the classic Maya period. And what we find is that there's a whole section of this devoted to beekeeping, specifically to stingless beekeeping, because these are native bees to our area of the world. People have interpreted, in fact, what we see here as stingless beehives. And what I'm showing you here is a stingless beehive from Brazil, and you can see the honey pots and pollen pots where bees store their food and perhaps are represented here. In terms of nature matters, why do we want to study bee communication? We know that they are important and, particularly nowadays, imperiled agricultural pollinators. and we can actually think about using them as bioindicators of environmental degradation. And finally, the large part of my talk will be focused on the stingless bees, because these are native to the rainforest regions of the world, which are particularly endangered in many places. Well, here's another symbol of the good life, at least in our generation, and that is the proverbial expression of bread and honey. But where does this come from? In fact, it comes from the natural flowers and environment, but quite often from agricultural products. We're probably familiar with the importance of bee pollination with almonds. In fact, this is so important that during the almond pollination season, almost 99% of all bee colonies in North America, includes the United States and Canada, end up in Sacramento just to pollinate this crop. We also have carrots, and this is something that I wasn't aware of, but these are pollinated by bees. And you might wonder why I have a cow here. Cows are not pollinated by bees, but in fact, hay and alfalfa are seed are bee pollinated. So in a way, this very important industry of raising cattle is also dependent upon honeybees. As you can see up here in California, over $1.5 billion in agriculture is directly related to bee pollination, with much more related to subsidiary products, and nationwide it's about $15 to $20 billion. Well, what about our environment? It turns out that bees, we have this amazing situation where you have a superorganism. You have a colony of thousands of individuals that are working in cooperation, exploring their environment to find food and bring it back. And of course, when they do that, they may also bring on their hairs other elements, perhaps looking for environmental contaminants. We could use bees in order to figure out where they've been and perhaps what dangers are out there for us. This, in fact, is a data set that I had students in one of my laboratory courses collect. This is La Jolla up here. This is an infrared image, so you see the Torrey Pines golf course, and it's centered actually around here where we keep a colony of bees in the La Jolla campus for this experiment. And what I had them do was actually decode the language of the bees. That's shown in this series of equations. But basically what we can now do is understand how honeybees communicate and from that determine the map coordinates of where they actually visited. So here's a case where we were able to decode a natural animal language and determine how it is that they not only get this information, but we can now use it to say, aha, this bee was visiting this spot right here. In fact, as part of this, we're now building a pollen database. This is a student project, and again, we've started around the UCSD campus. These blue lines are where he walked in order to look for bees visiting flowers, and the stars show where he actually found bees. So part of this project is to build up a record of the plants that are visited. Obviously, this is not a native species, but nonetheless, he has a photo here of the bee visiting the flower, the overall image of the tree, and then accession data. And in addition, very importantly, he collects a sample of the pollen that we preserve for genetic analysis. Our goal here is to be able to determine when a bee comes back, where that bee visited, which we can decode from its communication, and then also to look at what types and species of plants were visited. So this should actually give us an idea of what's going on in our environment, not only for introduced plants, but also for native plants. I was actually 2 years ago involved in this project, which may sound quite far-fetched, but the DARPA, the military, put out a proposal asking people to find a way where you could take a small insect with a payload, such as a bee that you see here, and actually deliver this to a remote location that you could program. And the idea here is to actually go with something which has actually worked before, where you can build a type of robot bee that will tell other bees where to fly. They bear this payload, and they wirelessly transmit information back. So this is something futuristic, but it actually is a direction that we could go in the future. Well, let me talk a little bit about recruitment now, because this is this intrinsic central phenomenon that allows us to know and perhaps do all of these wonderful things. So here we have a bee that is visiting a flower. She finds this fortuitously in the environment, and she returns to the nest. Now, in this cartoon, we've kind of satirized the idea of the kind of information that's being transferred, and that other bees, nest mates, pay attention to this lucky bee and will go out and collect that food source as well. What it really looks like is this. So a bee that we have painted, we've trained this bee, and she's coming back, she's exchanging her food, giving it up to other bees in the colony, who are then making it into honey. And in the process, she's producing sounds, she's dancing around, and she's attracting the attention of other individuals. What you're going to see here is a high-speed video, which has been slowed down so we can see it more clearly, of a bee that is waggle dancing for a food source. And because we now understand this dance communication system, I can look at this, and from the direction in which she's waggle dancing, give it a moment, so here she's waggling her abdomen, we can tell that this bee was advertising a food source about 100 meters away in the opposite direction of the sun. And if she were dancing, for example, in this case, it's more like 170 degrees to the opposite direction of the sun. But the basic idea is we're able to read this dance, and this is largely due to the contributions of this scientist here, Carl von Frisch, who won a Nobel Prize in conjunction with two other individuals for founding the field of ethology, but really it was for his amazing discoveries of this dance language. Now, Carl von Frisch naturally had a curiosity of understanding how did this communication system evolve, and he therefore asked one of his students, Lindauer here, to look into this question, and Lindauer actually chose to look at the stingless bees, which is really the root of my own work. By some odd chance, Lindauer was the advisor of my PhD advisor, so in a way I'm carrying on this tradition of studying stingless bees. One of the questions that I'd like to look at today is the question of why the waggle dance has evolved. Bees have a very remarkable ability to communicate and encode information. Why is this not more present in the animal kingdom? Why, for example, don't they just use odors like ants or many other social insects? And then finally, I wanted to return to the theme of endangered ecosystems and what bees can tell us about them. So here we have the Panamanian forest. This is actually an aerial photo of the site where I work on Barrow, Colorado Island. What's interesting about it is that here you see these trees that are mass flowering, and these, of course, are great for exploitation by a colony. One bee can find a flower, and then that colony can find the tree and get its nectar and pollen. And furthermore, understanding their foraging biology is really key to environmental stewardship, because in understanding how these native bees, what their needs are in terms of the size of reserves, the types of plants that they visit and pollinate, we really get key information not only about them, but preserving this larger ecosystem. So here's another picture of that site, and I wanted to introduce the stingless bees to you. They are all highly social, which means they have a colony with a single queen, and all of the individuals who are working are females. There are some males around, but they actually don't do any work. They just reproduce. And there is a tremendous species diversity. You can see here in terms of sizes and colorations of bees. But what you can also see here is that they have diverse lifestyles. There are some bees that are no longer collecting pollen or nectar. In fact, they rely upon finding small animals in the forest that have died, liquefying the flesh, and then bringing it back and storing it in honeypots. Now, finally, what's interesting, and perhaps it sort of matches with this idea of necrophagy, is that there is a very aggressive strategy, lifestyle, in fact, that's pursued by many stingless bee species, and that's going to be an important component of my talk today. Well, stingless bees are all tropical, so unfortunately, we don't get them in our neck of the woods, but you can see here they do range up to parts of Mexico, and they inhabit all areas in the tropics around the world, so they're very important to these regions. For my own work, I actually go to three different field sites, so one here in Chiapas, Mexico, one in Panama, and then also one in Brazil in the state of Sao Paulo. And I'm going to focus a little bit just to give you an idea of what our research site is like. This is a topo map of Barrow, Colorado Island, and this was formed by the flooding of Lake Gatun for the Panama Canal, which is actually shown here. Now, there's a great facility that is run by the Smithsonian, and it's shown here. This is their laboratory space, and we actually usually use a lab, which is here shown in red. And inside, we can place a honeybee colony, or sorry, a stingless bee colony, and this bee colony we've modified so we can observe the behaviors that are going on. So you can see here, there are bees. We can record with video cameras what they're doing, and also, more importantly, with microphones what is going on. Moreover, we can determine who has gone out to find the food. We train them to feeders, and we can mark them at the feeder with paint marks, or we can actually glue these little tags that are available. You might wonder how we train these bees. It turns out that if you place a rich sugar solution in a feeder next to the colony, the bees will eventually visit it, and then you can mark them, as is shown here. And then you can gradually carry this feeder further and further away in small steps. What now happens is that the bees will follow, and you can actually get them to go almost anywhere. We have in this example, he's actually strapped this to his back and is training the bees up to the top of this water tower to simulate a flowering tree. And here we have the feeder at the top. In other cases, I've actually placed the feeder in a canoe and rowed it across a water gap because I wanted to see if the bees could forage across water. So the underlying theme of this talk, and quite appropriate in this year in which we're approaching the 200th anniversary of Darwin's Origin of the Species, is how has bee recruitment communication evolved and what selective pressures have driven its evolution? Basically, why do we have this remarkable system? Here's an example of some of the extremes which bees and also the assistants will go to. You can see this is the top of the rainforest. He's about 40 meters high. Here's a cargo ship passing in the Panama Canal. And here's a feeder to which we are training the bees. Now, in the first phase of the experiment, we really just want to see, can the bees communicate food location? So we can train the bees to the top of this tower, and then at the base of the tower, we can place an identical feeder and see where the recruits, the nestmates, arrive. If they only come to the top of the tower, where the feeder is, then we know they have some specific height communication. And you can do the same thing to determine distance and direction communication. One of the main stories here is that habitat really matters, and it matters where the bees will find food in their normal environment. So here, Melipona mandacea lives in this very arid Caatinga habitat where you have a very cactus-like vegetation. You don't really have any tall plants, and all of the food is found on the floor of the habitat. And they do not communicate the height of the food source, but they do communicate distance and direction. Here in Melipona bicolor, we have an Atlantic rainforest species. This is the remnant of a once great rainforest which stretched throughout this area of Brazil, but now because of climate change has retreated to the coast. And here, an important food source is located at the top of the 12-meter high canopy, and bees can go to that specific height if food is offered there. But they do not have any specificity if you offer the food at the base. So these bees do not have a very good ability to communicate height. In the previous slide in Melipona panamica, living in this multi-story rainforest, they actually can do it within 10 to 20 meters. So they're very specific in their ability. Well, how do they do this? Now, you might have thought immediately about olfactory communication. You're probably familiar with seeing ants producing these trails which other ants can follow. Does something occur like that in stingless bees? Well, Lindauer and Kerr went to Brazil, and Lindauer discovered that some bees will produce these complete odor trails. Now, it's not like ants, because they're not crawling along a surface, they're flying, but sort of like a Hansel and Gretel effect, you have a bee flying, then landing every few meters, depositing an odor mark, and then landing again. So you have this trail of odor droplets going from the nest to the food source. He also found that some bees will have target-only odor marking. That is, they will only mark the food source, but not have any odor trail. Now, what does this look like? You can see here that you have a bee, and we've slowed this down, and it's repeated over and over again. You can see the bee is rubbing her mandibles and depositing that odor on the edge of the leaf. We now know that this is produced by the labial gland. One advantage of this is we can actually use this to study the odor trail. We can have a string or a rope decorated with these leaves, and the bees will actually happily land on them and deposit these odor trails. Well, you might wonder, okay, so they're doing this. How do you know that they're actually depositing any odor marks? Here we have a normal situation, and this was actually done on a grassy field, where we have the number of bees that were coming from the colony, so 250 over the course of the experiment, and we also have the number of odor marks. So this is the normal situation where they land on the grass, deposit odor marks, and recruits come. Well, what happens if you actually remove the marks? And so I had assistants that would run out whenever a bee landed on the grass. They would cut off the grass, remove it, seal it in a plastic bag. And this is what happened. Recruitment dropped drastically by a factor of 10. And what's interesting is the bees weren't stupid. They realized something was going on and noticed that the number of odor marks that they tried to produce doubled. So we were taking away their odors and they were furiously trying to replace them. But to no avail because they weren't getting very much recruitment. So this behavior is depositing an odor mark. Well, what evidence is there that this is a kind of odor trail? And here's a sort of fun experiment that I'll show you. We have this odor trail, which is being created by bees. We also have this string, which is along the ground. It turns out that bees only like to odor mark high objects, and then we can set the experiment in motion. So here we're displacing it to see, do bees come to this part that was marked or to this visually identical part that was not marked? And this other part here is kind of fun. We grab this, we run like crazy, and we rotate the odor trail by 180 degrees or 90 degrees to test and see, are these odor trails polarized? Can the bees actually determine from entering the trail what the correct endpoint is? And the answer in both cases is yes. They can use these odor trails, and they have odor trail polarization, something which is actually rather unusual in the animal world. The other point I wanted to emphasize is these are partial odor trails. So remember, Lindauer discovered complete odor trails. We find these odor trails that go from the food source only a short distance toward the nest, in this case only about 9 meters, even though the nest is about 100 meters away. So this is an example of perhaps you might call it an odor runway in which bees are able to orient towards this information in the last phase of getting close to the food source. Well, it might seem puzzling to you. Why do you have this diversity of strategies? Why not have a complete odor trail? And I hope to return to that in a moment. This odor trail can also be used to specify a three-dimensional location. This is, in fact, why we had the happy student there. You can see him waving, climb up this water tower. And when he does so, we find that the bees deposit an odor trail vertically. The width of these black circles represents the density of the odor marks. And you can see the density is highest at the top and then decreases going down. This density distribution is probably how the polarization is encoded, how they know which is the correct end to go to. And you have this at the top, or if it's at the base, the bees will simply follow this odor trail along the ground. Okay, well, now to some exciting stuff, some carnage. It turns out that I promised in the title that this would be in some ways about war and death, and in fact, a lot of that does happen in stingless bees. So they compete for food sources, but they're also highly aggressive. Here we have one aggressive species. This is an unaggressive larger species, but notice what happens. So she's pinning her by the wings, and she is going to take advantage of this string to do a pro wrestling move, spin her around, and she will be tossed off. This next video, same type of thing. My students call this King of the Hill. And you can see the small bee. The other bees are feeding at the center, but she's harassing them now. And think about this. The other bees are probably at least 4 times the weight and size of this one, but nonetheless, they are being very effectively driven away. So they try, but she's unrelenting, and she's not even trying to feed. Her only goal at this point is to conquer this feeder and take it for her colony. And she wins. Well, this actually aggressive aspect of foraging has been known in bees, and in fact, there are, in this aggressive species, they are known to attack 6 different species of birds that are also nectar feeders. They are pests in some areas, and what's remarkable here is that here you have the so-called killer bee, the Africanized honeybee, and what you can't see in this photo, but perhaps the blurriness suggests it, this stingless bee is grabbing the Africanized bee by the wing and flipping it back and forth, slamming it on this flower until she goes away. Here we have a video of a group of them ganging up on the Africanized honeybee, and what they're doing is they're systematically biting at her. Their eventual goal is to rip off her wings and legs and then cut off her head. We're not going to show you that. Well, what is the evidence that this actually occurs at natural food sources? Because so far I've showed you artificial feeders. Here is Dombea. This is a beautiful plant, and these flowers are native to this area of Brazil where you have this stingless bee community. So here are some of the species that visit Dombey, and you actually, if you peer in here, you can see some of these species. The top dog is this most aggressive species, Trigona yellanata. It really is at an 80% abundance, unlike some of these other species, which are nonetheless much larger. And here we have sort of a schematic of the aggression. So passive displacement often occurs. You see a bee approaching another bee, and the other bee just takes off. So there's no desire, or apparently, to get involved into a fight. And then we have low, medium, and high levels of aggression. This is the level of aggression where bees are grappling with each other, and it usually ends up in decapitation of both individuals. So this does occur for flowers. In order to study this in greater detail, it's easier to use artificial feeders. And in particular, we believe that pheromones are involved, so we can use this setup in which we have filter paper to collect the odor marks. So here we have what I call a victim species. This is Melipona rufoventris. It's feeding at the feeder. But it will soon be discovered by the aggressive Trigona, which you see is these stealthy black dots zooming around. They come, they attack, they take over. And here shown is this process over time. So here is the time going from 0 to 600 seconds. Here we have the relative numbers of bees on the feeder. You can see that initially we have the victim, Melipona rufoventris, but gradually its numbers decrease and the number of the aggressor species increases. The same way, they're feeding here, but here, of course, they're not, and the number of feeding up aggressive species dramatically increases at the end when they've won the food source. Initially, they're often fighting in pairs, but then this fighting goes down because the aggressive species has essentially won. And then when they've won, of course, they devote much more time to feeding than to fighting. Well, this brings us to the next part of the talk. Remember the long odor trails, the short odor trails, and just marking the feeder alone. Why would you want to do this? We could heed the advice of Sun Tzu, who wrote quite a long while ago that it's important to be subtle, and use your spies for every kind of business. And this leads to the question, can these aggressive species actually exploit the food marking odors of less aggressive species? After all, if you're living in an ecosystem where finding a food source can be scarce, and everyone else is providing this free information of odor marks, why do the hard work? Why not simply look for the odor marks that other bees have produced and use them to your own advantage? And that takes us to the idea of eavesdropping. We normally think of this in an auditory context, but in animal behavior, we also apply it to any kind of signal interception by an unintended receiver. So in order to test for eavesdropping, remember that white filter paper that I showed you, what we've done is we have gone to a site in which we've trained bees, and we offer them that white filter paper. Spinapes here is the aggressive species. And then we offer a filter paper that has been odor marked by the victim species, rufoventris. So here we have spinapes visiting the advertised site, and as you might expect, they orient to their own odors, the odors of their own colony. And these are actually the flight paths that I've digitized and shown how a bee approaches this odor and then eventually lands on the paper. What happens if you remove the food and searching begins? Any natural food source will eventually exhaust itself. So in this case, you would actually want to be able to find new food sources, and the bees are acting as scouts. So in this case, when they act as scouts, and you place at a new site, not the same location, but a location that's close by, about 10 to 20 meters away, what you find is now the behavior is quite different. They are orienting towards the odors of the victim species, and as you saw in the video, if they actually find bees there, they will kill them and then take over the feeder. Now, in this experiment, in order to prevent any kind of bias or visual orientation, we just had bees come one at a time, and we captured them as soon as they made their choice. So based upon odor alone, they can use the odors of the victim species and prefer them. By the way, the victim species is extremely intolerant of these aggressive species, and they will flee from those odors if they detect them. Well, what is a counter strategy to this kind of olfactory eavesdropping? And one possibility is that of short odor trails. So we had found that these bees produce shorter odor trails, and perhaps they're doing so in order to avoid these eavesdroppers, providing a little bit of less information, less help to those aggressive species. What's an alternative strategy? Well, you could eliminate the odor trail and mark only a single spatial point, that is the food source which you actually visited. And this is actually found in all Melipona species. This is a Melipona bee shown here. And this is what it looks like. So here we have Melipona quadrifasciata. And what you're about to see is that after she finishes feeding, she'll do this strange spinning behavior on the feeder. And in part, she's rubbing her abdomen, which may help transfer certain odors. And we also know that on her feet, on these tarsi, she also is secreting either hydrocarbons or a pheromone that is marking that food source. So this is how point source odor marking can look. Well, we've come to a problem here. The more you try to escape from these eavesdroppers, the less information you've provided for your own troops. So, what do you do? And here's where we enter the domain of acoustic communication. Perhaps there's another way that you can go. So here we have a stingless bee colony, and the point I wanted to emphasize is that this nest is actually a fortress. In harvesting these colonies, they choose tropical hardwoods of such density that we occasionally break our chainsaws trying to get at the nest. Moreover, they're defended by having a single, very small entrance, almost like a drawbridge, and they actually have large balls of resin just inside here. So if they're faced with an overwhelming force of ants, for example, they can plug up the entrance and subsist perfectly well, and the attackers are foiled. So in this environment, if you can bring the information back inside the nest, it is a secure location. Moreover, they also have nestmate recognition. Not only can they detect other species, but they can even know who rightfully belongs to their colony. So here we have an individual, same species as you can see, that came from a nearby colony. She got confused and she landed at the wrong entrance. Unfortunately for her, she's now being slowly ripped apart by the occupants of this colony. What goes on inside this colony? And I'll actually be showing you a video of that. So what you'll see is a bee coming in, moving these zigzag movements, spinning around, and then leaving the nest. That's what I wanted to show you in this slide. There are two distinct phases that are going on here, which actually communicate two different types of information. So first we have a bee coming in, and she's unloading her food. These are images taken from a video that you're about to see. And as she's doing so, she's producing loud pulsed sounds. And in addition, of course, she carries the odor of the food that she's visited on her body. And these bees take the sugar and they make it into honey. During the dance phase, what you saw in the previous slide, that swirling and moving around of the bee is actually spinning around. And what's interesting is the other bees are quite interested in this, and some of these bees will actually subsequently show up at that same location. She's again producing these loud pulse sounds, and therefore I call this the dance phase. Okay, so here is the video, and what you're about to see is this bee performing her recruitment behavior. Actually, could we have that turned up? So here it is again. So very chaotic, but I hope the impression that you get is that of excitement, that she has something that she is trying to communicate either through vibrations or sounds or motions to other bees inside the colony. If we were to look at the sounds specifically that she's producing, we can actually show them as a waveform. So in this waveform where you have this portion, it represents a pulse of sound followed by another pulse of sound. So here we have two food sources, one in which we've placed it and trained the bees to the base of this canopy tower, and one in which we've placed the feeder at the top of the canopy tower, 40 meters high. The canopy tower is in the same location, so it's the same distance, about 100 meters from the nest. You're about to listen to these sounds, what this sounds like when bees come from the bottom. Okay. So what you heard there, although it was quite noisy, is a series of rather long sound pulses. Contrast this with these sounds from the top. So it sort of sounds like ducks quacking or something bird-like, but you actually could tell that there are shorter sound pulses that are being produced here. Now, what's interesting is distance. Now, remember I talked about the two phases? So here we have the unloading phase. This is apparently where the height information is communicated, how high that food source is. And here, in the dance phase, is where we have data for communication of distance. And so here, for 50 meters...
50 meter.
And then at 360 meters, we have longer pulses.
360 meter.
So the basic story is, in this dance phase, they're communicating distance, and there are longer pulses that correlate to increasing distance to the food source. Well, so far I have indeed only shown you correlations, so how do we establish that this isn't actually the case? One of the latest things we've been doing is we've been trying to get a better sense of how loud these sounds are and to increase the purity of the sounds that we record. As you saw, there's a lot going on inside the nest. There is a lot of activity, and we pick all of that up with our pressure microphones, the same type of microphone I'm talking to you through right now. In this case, we're actually using beams of laser light, which we can focus on a single individual that's producing a sound, as shown here, and we can record the sounds that she's producing. So you see here a bee, she's come back, she's unloading her food to other bees. She has this paper tag that is reflective of the light, and in addition, we can actually apply small paint marks so we can distinctively identify them. And compare what you heard before with the new and improved sound recordings. Okay, so this is the actual vibration that she's producing on her thorax, and this is what is generating sound and putting it out there. Now, you might wonder about the noisiness of this. In fact, bees hear in a different way than we do, and their hearing is only good when they are very close to a sound source. So for them, we believe they're getting this very pure type of sound. Well, here is data from two colonies from increasing distances. And you can see that overall there is a good general fit between the average duration of these sound pulses and increasing distance to the food source. Well, one way in which it's popular or common to test ideas about acoustic communication is to do a playback. This is challenging because playbacks... For animals like us that have eardrums, we can use speakers, devices that we've developed. For a bee, it's difficult. You would actually have to build something like a robot bee with wings moving in the correct way. But another thing that you can do is simply to vibrate the surface on which they're standing, because we believe these vibrations are also involved in communication. What we have here is a setup in the lab in which we have signals, and these are artificially generated signals, but we also can do this with natural signals. We have recorded these signals, and we actually have in this black cylinder here a way of vibrating very precisely the substrate to mimic the natural sound signals. And then this laser equipment is just making sure that that signal is at the correct amplitude and is not distorted for the bees. So here are the preliminary results, and what we do is we set out three feeders, and we have assistants monitoring them. We have one feeder at 25 meters, to which we've trained bees, and we have controls at 0 and 50 meters. So it turns out that if you just vibrate the nest, they don't get it. They need something of a bee coming back, exchanging food. So this experiment has to do with, can you increase the successful recruitment to a location, or can you decrease it? It turns out that if you play back sounds for this 25 meters that were previously recorded, you can actually increase visits to the 25-meter location and only to that location. If you play back sounds for 0 or 50 meters, well, there are no bees visiting these locations, and there's no effect. There are no bees that will visit the locations. Well, what if you play back white noise to interfere with the sounds that they're producing? It turns out that visitation decreases. So you can interfere with this communication system. And this provides good evidence as well, and it's something that actually we've been working on quite recently. Okay, what about actually doing something in which you can trick the bees to go to a location that the other trained bees are not actually visiting? This would be a great experiment because you might say, well, maybe they're visiting because they smell an odor at this particular location. What if you get them to go to a location that they've never visited before? And this is where we come up with the optic flow experiments. It turns out that bees perceive distance in a very different way from us. Because of the way their eyes are oriented, they're very sensitive to optic flow, the movement of the environment around them. If you've ever driven on a freeway, I'm sure you all have driven on a freeway around here, you'll notice that the signs close to you are moving very rapidly, the mountains are moving very slowly. And this is the effect that bees are picking up on. When they are flying and the objects are moving by, they're actually calculating the distance from that. So this is how we do it. We have a tunnel. It's lined with this black and white pattern that provides very strong optic flow. The bees come, visit a feeder. They will actually fly out of the tunnel quite happily. And then to test it, we actually have to change out the tunnel because, after all, they could have deposited odors. But this is a fresh tunnel with new paper. And the bees will come by, and they will actually go back and forth searching in the location where they thought the food was. Okay, so in this case, it was in the center of the tunnel. But the real trick is, what, in fact, would happen if you narrowed the walls of the tunnel? Now they're getting much more optic flow, and you would predict that they would search near the entrance of the tunnel. And that's exactly what happens. If you make the tunnel wider, you would predict the bees would search closer to the end of the tunnel because they're getting less optic flow. And that's what happens. So in this tunnel, we can train bees, and we can give them a level of optic flow to trick them into thinking where the food actually is. So here's what happens in this type of experiment. We're testing the communication by seeing if we can trick the recruits, the novice bees, into visiting a different location. In the control experiment, if there's no exaggerated optic flow, we place a feeder inside a box and we place another feeder at the same distance, 6 meters, we see that the recruits will go to the 6-meter feeder. Okay, so they're getting a normal level of optic flow, and they go to the distance that the other bees are visiting. But here we have exaggerated optic flow. So we make them fly inside this tunnel. They're going back, and they're communicating a distance that they have perceived. But the recruits take this information, and they don't go to this 6-meter feeder. In fact, they're tricked into going to a feeder that's 10 times further away, 60 meters away, instead of this closer feeder. And it's a very strong effect. We have 92% of them going to that distance. Well, you might say, all right, but maybe they're just kind of going out to a greater distance. What proof is it that this is specific? And with exaggerated optic flow, you find that 91% of the recruits still are persisting at the 60-meter distance. They're not going further. For example, we have a feeder at 87 meters. So it is providing a precise exaggeration of distance that they're communicating inside the nest and telling other bees where to go. And this could not be any environmental odors because, after all, the other bees are not visiting 60 meters. They're going to 6 meters, the ones that are communicating. Well, the next question, what I was working on in Panama, actually, is the sound pulse duration shown here correlated with the amount of optic flow? And our preliminary results show very strongly yes. So the more optic flow that you perceive inside this type of tunnel situation, the longer your sound pulses are going to be. Now, you might remember about the height. What about that? Here's an experiment that we have ongoing. This is the actual canopy tower. And we actually, in this case, have a very long tunnel that is composed of cloth. But in other experiments with shorter tunnels, we find that we can use optic flow to misdirect the bees to the incorrect height. Just the same as distance, it also works for height. And it turns out the optic flow that they experience when flying up, when they're moving vertically, actually correlates with the sounds that they're producing when they're unloading food. Okay, so it seems like the story is working out in a satisfying way. The bees are producing these sounds. They can be misdirected by sounds being played back. They can go to a specific location when the sounds are played back, and they can be predictably misdirected when you change that distance or height that they've perceived they've flown, and that also affects their sounds. So, in conclusion, we have a wide variety of recruitment communication strategies. We have complete odor trails, partial trails, and target-only odor marks. And this really got me into thinking about, why do we have this? We also have odor trail polarization. You might wonder, well, why do we need that? If you think about it, in these partial odor trails that are polarized, you're providing less information about where the food is, and so anything would help, and if you can specify the correct endpoint of the trail, that would be helpful. What has driven this, I suggest that direct competition, the dramatic examples of aggression that you saw, plays an important selective role in the life of these bees. At certain times of the year, such as in the rainy season, even in tropical areas, there can be a great scarcity of food. And at these times, bee colonies can starve and die. And you can also find natural food sources in which thousands of dead bees, many of them with their heads cut off, are littering the ground because they've been fighting over these. And, of course, you would want to, therefore, avoid this kind of aggression, this kind of olfactory eavesdropping. Well, it turns out that there does appear to be encoded location information. Certainly the sounds contain distance and height information. And the recruits can be misdirected to a specific distance by nestmates using this odd measure of distance that bees use, optic flow. Well, where does this take us, and how does it really apply to, you know, what we're doing here at UCSD and our local community? Many of you have probably heard about colony collapse disorder, this disappearance of the honeybees, and in fact, we lost about 80 to 90% of our colonies in this past field season. Here's one of our my graduate students, and he's actually using the same experience that we've developed with optic flow, but now applying it to honeybees, to a very specific question. We know that in optic flow, there's a mystery. You go to the colony, it was healthy a week ago, no one's inside. It's a ghost town. What happened to all the bees? Normally, when you have bee diseases, you have a lot of dead bees around the colony or inside. It's possible that they're actually getting lost. When you think about the great distances they have to travel, if there is something that impairs that navigation system, perhaps it will affect their ability to return to the nest. And that's, in fact, what we're testing. We're looking at the effect of pesticides, which are one causative factor implicated in this, and seeing when bees are given small sublethal doses of pesticides, doses which we think are safe, does it actually affect their ability to calculate distance? And we're using this optic flow tunnel to test that. Now, in addition, I think that one of the most important things that we do is really to provide stewardship for the next generation. Because what good is all of this if people don't have an important sense of where this is going and why it's important to fund and learn? So our lab has started this program called ORBS, Opportunities for Research in the Behavioral Sciences, where we involve students from community colleges and underprivileged serving schools to come in, learn about research, and actually participate in it. And in fact, we hosted a conference in 2004, and we'll be doing it again, in which we had participation from several groups around San Diego, the Preuss School, the San Diego Unified School District, Southwestern College, San Diego City College, and also the Hub SeaWorld Research Institute, to come together to try to find a community of people that were interested in behavioral research, and moreover, to promote the science we were doing and really show people that nature does matter. So I'd like to conclude by thanking the many people that have contributed to this research, and most importantly, to the bees, their products, and their amazing communication system. Thank you. So the question is about the death of honeybees of late. People feel that it is, in a way, a sort of perfect storm. You have four different factors which we believe are important. One are these sublethal pesticides that are certified to be safe, but they will accumulate in a bee colony from generation to generation, and it's really uncertain how much of a dosage they're getting. The second is the fact that we have a parasite called Varroa destructor. I like that name. Makes me think of some kind of Godzilla-like creature. And there really is no treatment for Varroa. When it was introduced from Asia, it destroyed 25% of all honeybee colonies in this country, and we still have no effective treatment. Another important factor is virus. We've probably heard, or perhaps you've heard about this IAPV virus, which is implicated in some instances of colony collapse. So there's a whole host of viral and bacterial diseases. In general, our research in the bee community suggests that bees are not very healthy. And then finally, we have this economic factor. We have migrant beekeeping, this conglomeration of bee colonies from all around North America. Imagine the fact that 90% of these colonies are showing up in the Sacramento Valley at one time of year. They're coming in close contact with each other. The way they're trucked around on semis, and perhaps you've heard in the news about a semi overturning, millions of bees spilling out on the freeway, they can mix with each other, they can move from colony to colony, and they can spread diseases. And unfortunately, some of these businesses are not necessarily concerned about the bees. They get paid for pollination. And so in the old days, when a bee colony would die, they would simply take that box and the combs and put a fresh bee colony in. Well, we wouldn't wear the clothes of someone who had died from the plague, and that's what they were doing with the bees. Well, that's interesting. So there are a variety of toxins in bee venom, about 100 different chemicals, some of them designed for inflammation, others for pain. And the onion, in actually the reason why you cry is it forms a kind of sulfuric acid compound when it's when the cells are broken. So I could imagine that it could also degrade some of the venom. But I've also heard of ammonia and that favorite meat tenderizer. Yes?
Bat colonies are dying off as well. Is there any correlation between that and the bees?
I haven't heard of any correlation between that of bees and bat colonies, although, again, it'd be interesting to see, because some bats feed on fruits, whether pesticide might be involved. Yes, there was another question actually over there.
You mentioned that the effect of pesticides.
So right now we're just at the preliminary stages. We know from other studies that bees that are exposed to pesticide, sometimes they don't return to the nest, they seem to get disoriented, and they have greater difficulties in learning. So we're hoping to expand on that. I think there was, yes?
I heard something about cellular antennas interfering or frequencies.
Right, so there was a big splash in the media. I think often we tend to infer things that we're concerned about with the bees. There was also something about fructose and bees. But it turns out that the cell antenna thing was overblown. I actually took a look at the paper, and the results weren't very convincing at all that there was an effect. Yes?
What about the magnetic field of the Earth producing gas? How's that affect you?
So the question is about the magnetic field of the Earth. Remarkably, bees are sensitive to the magnetic field, and they will actually build their combs along a preferred north-south axis if they can. And they do appear to use that for orientation. So it's interesting. Yes?
Well, you said that that some of those bees would commingle and go into each other's hives, but then you showed that one bee that made a mistake and went into that one hive, they attacked and killed it, even though they were the same species. Do some bees allow others to come in and out of the same hive?
Right, so the question is, do some honeybees let their guard down? And in fact, they do. They're a little bit less stringent than these stingless bees, and they have a much wider opening. And it turns out that if you bear gifts, you're welcome. And so if a bee comes back with nectar, she is likely to be given admittance. Okay, so just one more question, I think. Yes?
Do other insects like wasps also pertain as far as when they move around and stuff like same communication?
Great. You know, that's a good question because we're interested in the... Oh, the question is, do other insects such as wasps, do they also have a similar type of communication system? We have found that in one species, Polybia occidentalis, which lives in the tropics, that wasps coming back from a food source will go around and bite other wasps. And the other wasps that are bitten will go out and presumably go forage for food, but we don't know more details about it. We're just at the beginning stages. There are some remarkable similarities there, even though we know that they evolved their systems independently of bees. Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.